You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
It's Monday, November 27th, and we're talking Cardinals baseball. We bring in Cards reporter for MLB.com, Jennifer Langosch. Jennifer, thanks as always for taking the time. And of course, everyone wants to know about Giancarlo Stanton, so we'll begin there. A formal trade offer from the Cardinals on the table to the Marlins. What's the latest? Are the Cards the front runners at this point? What can you tell us?
You know, they're among the most interested, I think I'll put it there. And one of these weeks when I do this podcast, I'll actually have some new tangible information. But right now, the Cardinals, like many teams out there, kind of just playing the waiting game. They have already made their formal offer to the Miami Marlins. We know from reports that the Giants have as well. Right now, it looks like Miami is trying to wait out to see what other teams are interested and what other packages might be offered. Of course, the caveat in all this, too, is that Stanton has to approve any trade because of that no-trade clause that he has in his contract. So for the Cardinals, I don't see this coming to a conclusion in the coming days. This might be something that lingers here the next couple weeks up until the winter meetings. But no secret that the Cardinals remain very interested in the Miami Slugger. This is a team that really needs and has prioritized the need to add an impact bat to its lineup for 2018 and beyond. And when you talk about impact hitters, I think at the top of that list is Stanton. And then, of course, while the Cardinals are waiting for Miami, they continue to kind of look at plans B, C, and D, what other hitters are out there and where they might have to pivot if it doesn't work out with Miami.
I thought you were going to come right on, Jennifer, and say, that's it. They've traded for Stanton, and we break it right here. But all right, that might happen soon enough, though. We'll see. Just continuing with Stanton before we switch gears a little bit more, how does the obviously, the fans, everyone wants Giancarlo Stanton on their team. It would be amazing. But how do the front office manage expectations of the fans with, of course, players that would have to be dealt and the money and the long-term commitment to one individual player like that? Is that a bit of a balancing act right there in terms of managing those expectations?
Yeah, this is a very complex situation because you have so many different factors in play here. I mean, as you mentioned, you have the contract, which would blow away any contract the Cardinals have ever taken on for a player. I mean, you're talking almost $300 million guaranteed to Stanton over the next 10 years. So that's one element of it. And, you know, what we don't have clarity on is how much salary relief the Cardinals would be asking for from the Marlins in any type of deal. The second part of the deal, of course, would be the prospects involved. Now, the Cardinals are in good negotiating position because they have so much young talent, in particular, young pitching talent and outfield talent. And so you would expect the Cardinals, you know, to try to deal away with those surpluses. But again, how much are they willing to deal away? This is an organization that has long built success based on its farm system by drafting and developing players. And, you know, how willing are they to kind of give up on some of those players for a big bat like Stanton? So you have those two elements. You have the no trade clause in there. And as you mentioned, you have the fan expectations. And I can tell you just over the last few weeks since the World Series ended and free agency opened, Stanton is the talk of the town. I mean, baseball may not be being played here in St. Louis, but if you turn on sports talk radio, if you read anything in town these days, it's all about this idea of will Giancarlo Stanton come to St. Louis? So I think fans would be disappointed, of course, if it doesn't work out. That being said, I think for the Cardinals, you know, the priority has to be to add someone. So if it's not Stanton, again, perhaps they pivot elsewhere and address their needs in a different way. But this is definitely a fan base looking for a big, bold move from a team that, quite frankly, in recent years hasn't made a lot of those in the hot stove season.
Absolutely. And as you detailed there very well, I mean, it's a complex situation. I promise this is the last Stanton question here. But I just want to get your take. This kind of just came into my head when I was thinking about in terms of looking at the Cardinals in the past. Albert Pujols was 31. Of course, different situation. He was on the team and then a free agent back in 2011 and was commanding a lot of money on the open market. The Cardinals elected not to pay that. Pujols goes to the Angels. Different scenario, but with a guy like Stanton, he's 28. You'd have to commit a lot of money, even if there was some salary relief, as you said. Is that part of the issue for the Cardinals, really, in just that huge amount of money and time and years when a player could break down in their mid-30s?
Yes, and I think there's a lot that we can learn from what the Cardinals did and didn't do with the Albert Pujols negotiations that still hold true today. I mean, one of those is this is a very prudent organization. They don't just throw money around there. I mean, they're very deliberate about attaching a value to a player and wanting to stick with it. We saw that with Albert. They didn't react emotionally. If they wanted to offer him more money, they had the financial flexibility to do so, but they also realized that it didn't make sense for the long-term viability of this organization. And I think the same holds true with Stanton. I mean, they're not going to go out and get him at any cost, and that cost being both financial and in terms of prospects. You know, I think, too, for fans, you know, there's always a lot of talk about payroll. Are the Cardinals going to spend more money? Spending more money alone doesn't always just make you better. I mean, some of the contracts that we've seen in recent years, some of the biggest contracts, they eventually become albatrosses for those organizations. And again, St. Louis isn't in position to be able to take on bad contracts and kind of overcome that. So they have to be very deliberate with their moves. They're not afraid to make big moves, but they have to be the right ones. And so, again, that's going to come down to what they feel is the right package in terms of prospects and money that they're willing to take on, as well as comparing Stan to the other available options out there.
Yeah, and of course, the goal is to win a World Series, not necessarily to make the biggest offseason splash, too. So they have to weigh that, and we can segue with that into some Hall of Fame talk. Three members of the Cardinals World Series championship team back in 2006 are on this year's Hall of Fame ballot. Third baseman Scott Rolen, closer Jason Isringhausen, starting pitcher Chris Carpenter. In the likeliest of those three, in your mind, to be able to get in into the Hall of Fame?
The likeliest, I think, would be Scott Rolen. And I think he has a very interesting case. I mean, you look at the career spanning, I believe, from 1996 to 2012, kind of the middle years there is where he spent in St. Louis. But you're talking about someone who began his career as a Rookie of the Year, won 8 Gold Glove Awards, 7-time All-Star. You know, you look at where he ranks among Major League third basemen, you know, 15th all-time in home runs, 12th all-time in RBIs. He had a long, successful career both on the offensive and defensive ends. You know, my question is going to be, how much consideration does he get with a crowded Hall of Fame ballot? We saw this a couple years ago, you know, particularly as it pertains to St. Louis with Jim Edmonds. Here was a guy who a lot of people thought had maybe borderline Hall of Fame credentials, but because there were so many other worthy candidates on the ballot, such a crowded ballot, and the ability to only vote for up to 10 players, Edmonds didn't get enough support to even make it back onto the ballot for year number two. So, you know, my hope for Scott, of course, he's not going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer, but that he at least gets enough consideration and enough votes to come back on this ballot year after year and maybe warrant a little bit more discussion. As for, you know, Chris Carpenter, Isringhausen, well, Carpenter has already been inducted into the Cardinals Hall of Fame. I would expect Izzy to be as well. Rolen probably follows him in addition to that. But as far as the National Baseball Hall of Fame, I think it's Scott Rolen who probably has the best chance.
Yeah, and I think, as you said, sometimes it's just being able to get on the next ballot for the next time around as well. That's important to be able to eventually obviously get in. Going back to the current team right now, a guy that the Cardinals have expectations for going into next season, Jose Martinez. You wrote about him recently. He's honing his first base skills a bit more in the Venezuelan League right now, and the Cardinals potentially using him more at first base next season. Do you expect to see that?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense for Jose to use his time down in Venezuela to work at the position. I mean, we saw him play a good amount of first base this year, but it was really his first kind of extended exposure at the position. So, you know, he went back home. He always plays in Venezuela back home, but he's never played this much first base, but really wants to be able to come into spring training feeling even better defensively at that spot. You look at Jose Martinez, I still don't believe that he probably projects to open the season as a starter in any position for the Cardinals, but adding to that versatility and, of course, what he's been able to offer, you know, in a short period off the bench makes him a very, very valuable reserve player. So no surprise to me either that you look down at what he's doing offensively in Venezuela and he's lighting it up at the plate, kind of a carryover from the season he had here in St. Louis. And, you know, if he's able to play a very capable first base along with being able to spell the outfielders in either corner spot, it's only going to make him more valuable and it's only going to kind of create more playing time for him, I think, next year.
Absolutely. We're talking with Jennifer Langosch of MLB.com. And Jennifer, before we wrap things up, obviously the offseason, everyone's talking about trades, free agency, money, but there's a lot of work being done in the community by teams and individual players really trying to help their communities in a lot of different ways and giving their time. You wrote a great piece a couple of weeks ago about what some Cardinals players are doing. I was wondering if you could just detail that a bit more.
Yeah, I always like doing it at this time of year. I mean, right, we all talk about this being the season of giving, and I don't think oftentimes A lot of the players and even the organization are recognized for all they do to give back to this community. I mean, you think back to this season alone, Dexter Fowler donating $100,000 of his own money to help dedicate a field in Illinois in kind of a low income area. You look at the work that Yadier Molina and Matt Carpenter did to help raise funds for hurricane relief. I mean, Yadi raising money and then spending 2 weeks back in his home in Puerto Rico, literally going door to door, delivering water and food and supplies to people in his hometown. Matt Carpenter, of course, pledging money per home run, which followed, you know, which then created other pledges per home run, raised almost $200,000 for his hometown of Houston as it still recovers from Hurricane Harvey. You have guys like Adam Wainwright, whose fantasy football fundraiser has kind of grown out of St. Louis and across the country into different cities, having raised multiple millions of dollars, largely for food and water needs around the world. Carlos Martinez and his foundation. There's so much going on, again, with a lot of these players that I don't think is often brought to the forefront. So the piece on Cardinals.com kind of highlights some of those efforts, as well as some of the work that the Cardinals and the Cardinals Care organization has done here in St. Louis, particularly to help children and underserved areas in the St. Louis region.
Yeah, it's great, Jennifer, just to be able to read about that and hear about those stories, because like you said, sometimes they're not on the forefront of everyone's minds, but delving into it is a pretty cool thing to do. As always, Jennifer, thanks so much for the time, and maybe next week you'll have some breaking news on Stanton, right?
One of these days, I hope to deliver some breaking news on this podcast, so stay tuned.
I love it. All right, thanks so much, Jennifer. We appreciate the time as always. I'm Darwin Zook. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's Monday, November 27th, and we're talking Pirates baseball. We bring in Pirates reporter from MLB.com, Adam Berry. Adam, thanks as always for taking the time. And it's been a tough path, as we all know, over the last year for Jung Ho Kang, released today by his Dominican Winter League team, batting just 143 in 24 games with one homer. It's been quite a saga for Kang. So where do the Pirates and Kang as a player go from here?
Yeah, this doesn't really change anything as far as his standing with the Pirates. That much is still every bit in question, as it was when the offseason began, and really dating back to May when his application for a work visa was denied following his offseason DUI arrest in South Korea. This is more just about his performance in the Dominican Winter League, which was not great. You mentioned the stats there. You know, for the Pirates and for Kang, this was kind of just like a rehab development time, you know, just sort of shake off the rust, get his feet back under him. The Pirates could get their eyes on him in a more organized setting and see how he's come along in the unlikely event that he is able to play next year. So I think from that perspective, the Pirates did, you know, see where he's at physically. They were pleased with that. Obviously, there was rust from not having played for a year. But people forget that these Dominican winter ball teams are really competitive. So his club had every possible right to, you know, give him a shot, and they did. They batted him clean up for a long time. They moved him down the lineup. They benched him. And then finally, you know, they decided they want to win, and they have other guys that want to play. So they released him. And it's my understanding that he'll head back to South Korea for now. And I suppose when the calendar flips, the Pirates will wait and see what they can do as far as getting him a work visa. And that'll be the determining factor for whether he's able to play for the Pirates or make it to the United States next year. At this point, the Pirates are pretty well prepared to move forward in the offseason without him. That's kind of been their thing since they went out and they got Sean Rodriguez after the August trade deadline. So this doesn't really change anything in that regard. It's just a little bit discouraging that Kang wasn't able to make the most of that winter league, winter ball opportunity.
And Adam, just to quickly follow up, just kind of came into my head now, in terms of where do GMs and how much stock do they put in winter league ball or in the Arizona Fall League, whatever it is in that situation? How much do they look at as just, okay, this is about a player getting healthy, or is it when it's a younger player or even younger, is it about, okay, can this guy help the team even next year? How much stock is put into that?
I think it depends on the goal going into winter ball. So, you know, for like Starling Marte, you're not going to say, oh, how's he doing there? Or even Jose Ozuna, who you have kind of a representative sample size in the majors and the minors of what he's able to do. You know, maybe it gives you an idea of mechanical changes they've made or stuff that they've been told to work on, especially with big leaguers. That's kind of what you gain from that. Prospects, you know, you get a sense of what they might do against, you know, some of the top competition in the fall league for, you know, the prospects that may go out there. But I'd say for the most part, it's just about getting the extra work. The Pirates typically use the off-season leagues for guys who miss time due to injuries, or like Marte with the suspension, or Gong from being on the restricted list all year. So it's not huge necessarily from an evaluation standpoint. I know Neil Huntington really likes it because he thinks the competitive nature of it that I referenced with Jung-Ho Gong is actually really good for players who have not, you know, played in the big leagues or played in the playoffs or anything like that, because you know, they may be off-season leagues to us, but they're very meaningful in those countries. So I think it's a good experience. I don't necessarily think it's something where you're going to, you know, judge a player's worth or value completely off of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that makes sense for sure. And a couple minor moves made by the Pirates, one today and in the last week as well. Obviously, it's kind of the calm before the storm, the winter meetings a couple weeks away. But the minor moves, as you reported today, Sam Moll claimed by the Pirates off waivers from the A's, 25-year-old lefty reliever. And then also kind of a fan favorite, backup shortstop Gift Ngope, first African-born player to reach the majors. He was traded to the Blue Jays. Talk to us a little bit about those two moves.
Yeah, Sam Moll kind of fits in their search for left-handed relief options. I wrote today that you can kind of tick away how they cut away at the depth of their left-handed bullpen options. Antonio Bastardo was ineffective and released in July. They traded Tony Watson, who by that point had become a lefty setup man at the trade deadline. They did not exercise Wade LeBlanc's option, and then they dropped Ann Runsler off the 40-man and outrighted him. So at this point, they have three lefties on the 40-man other than Rivera, or three lefty reliever options other than Felipe Rivera, of course, the closer. And it's Jack Leathersich, Nick Turley, another waiver claim earlier this month, and now Sam Moll. So those are all three inexperienced guys. The Pirates like to, you know, take chances and try to find value where other people might not be looking for it, where it's affordable, such as on the waiver wire. So it kind of makes sense that they would take a shot on him. Some of these guys don't make it to spring training. Some of them don't last a month on the roster, you know, get dropped off, and the Pirates have to make other moves. But they had the open roster spot. They need a left-hander. Might as well take a chance and see if this guy who, you know, they've liked, and they like some of his indicating numbers in the minors especially, just see if he works out or maybe can stay in the organization and provide some depth in an area where they need it. Gift Ngope is actually a completely different story in the sense that they have enough depth they feel like at shortstop. And it was pretty apparent in September that he wasn't necessarily in their long-term plan. As good as he was, you know, in the minors and some of the improvements that he showed offensively, you know, and as great as his glove is, he's pretty much unquestionably their best defender in the system at all times. Maybe short of Starling Marte, that's probably about it. There just wasn't really a fit anymore. You know, they can't really carry an all-glove utility player given some of their offensive needs. They focused in September on Max Moroff and Sean Rodriguez behind Jordy Mercer at shortstop. And then they have a long line of prospects, actually, at the shortstop position coming up. Kevin Newman in AAA, Cole Tucker probably in AA, Stephen Alamez in Class A, and then Adrian Valerio down below him in A-ball as well. So they have some depth there. I know it was tough for the Pirates to cut ties with Gift just because he's a really likable guy. He, you know, was an incredible story, first African-born a player to reach the majors, grew up in a baseball clubhouse in South Africa with his mother who passed away while he was with the Pirates. His little brother signed with the Pirates out of South Africa as well. So I know it wasn't easy in a personal standpoint, but it made sense for the Pirates to, you know, use that 40-man spot somewhere else and to give Gift another opportunity, and maybe he'll catch on in Toronto.
We're talking with MLB.com's Adam Berry. And Adam, we talked about a couple minor moves there that you went through, and some of the bigger moves could be coming as we get towards winter meetings. There's been some Gerrit Cole trade rumors, perhaps. Andrew McCutchen, face of the franchise, but seems like he's staying put, and the core seems to be staying intact. Is there a bit of a balance right now trying to figure out, okay, are we trying to build around our veteran core star players, or maybe even use those guys to get younger and sort of start over, if you will? Or is the focus really just continue to keep Cole, keep McCutchen, and build around them as we get towards the winter meetings?
Yeah, I think that is the goal, to build around those guys. You know, things can change. If they get an offer that they like, they could trade McCutchen. I think that's unlikely heading into his last year of club control. I don't think they trade him this offseason. I think he's the center fielder batting third on opening day. And they could trade Cole, but that's probably even more unlikely because he's 2 years away and he's coming off of, in some regards, a good year based off of his workload and his strikeouts and his stuff. but the numbers quite aren't at peak value, so I don't know if it's a time to trade him. There was a rumor, I think somebody out of Minnesota reported that the Twins have expressed an interest or have spoken internally or one of those buzzwords this time of the offseason. And, you know, those offers are going to happen. There's going to be those discussions because Gerrit Cole is young, controllable, and when he's right, very good. So I don't think that's going to happen yet, if only because the Pirates have a lot of depth in the rotation. They don't have a lot of top-end depth. They don't necessarily have a guy, you know, I don't know who their opening day starter would be if it wasn't Gerrit Cole next year. And it's really hard to imagine the Pirates, unless they completely retrench and do decide to rebuild, which is the other plan you mentioned, I don't see them moving on from Gerrit Cole at this point. This time next year, I think it's a very real conversation. Maybe at the trade deadline, if they fall off and aren't contending, Gerrit Cole might be a really intriguing piece, you know, with a year and a half of control, top end of the, you know, rotation potential. But I don't see it happening this offseason. So there's going to be a lot of talk, but probably not a lot of action.
Yeah, and I mean, the Pirates do have young pitchers in the system, too, that pitched well in the Arizona Fall League, Mitch Keller, Taylor Hearn as well. So they want to see how those guys develop, and maybe sooner than later they could get into that rotation at the major league level. Adam, just wanted to switch gears before we wrap up here. Always a lot of talk about money and contracts and trades, but sometimes we forget about the really great efforts going on off the field and in the community. And you wrote about the hurricane relief effort that the Pirates are involved in down in Puerto Rico. I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that and what the players are doing down there.
Yeah, the Pirates, actually, when they got back at the end of the season, they made an effort to go down to Puerto Rico to provide some hurricane relief. They wanted to bring the supplies that they gathered through the courtesy of Pittsburghers and Pirates fans and some of the local businesses here in Pittsburgh. They actually gathered them in a relief drive for 2 days outside PNC Park, basically right after the end of the season. I gathered that and then took it personally on a FedEx cargo plane, two FedEx cargo planes actually, down to Puerto Rico, where Joey Cora, Mike Gonzalez, and Sean Rodriguez actually went out into towns and donated those supplies. Sean Rodriguez and Mike Gonzalez literally went door to door.
Wow.
In Gonzalez's hometown of Calle, and handed out supplies. And the stories they told and that I tried to relay in the feature that I wrote on Thanksgiving were really incredible. I think the one thing that they took away, as well as Cora, was, yeah, it's depressing, and there's a lot of heartbreak, and it's really hard to see, you know, the island still getting back on its feet after the hurricane, so many people without power and water, and, you know, in this, the land of Roberto Clemente, who obviously means so much to the Pirates and to Pittsburgh. But there was so much fight in the people, and I thought that was really neat to hear from Cora and Gonzalez, who are both Puerto Rican. So that was a really neat thing that the Pirates did, basically from the top down, from owner Bob Nutting, team president Frank Coonley, right down to the players, and especially the fans who came out to donate supplies, water, you know, anything they could spare. It was a really neat thing that the Pirates did. And it's like you said, you know, people get caught up, especially in October and heading into the off season, on the moves and, you know, the postseason and all that kind of stuff. And then you realize also that there are bigger picture things that the organization can do, not just the team. And a lot of those things are very good, like this effort that the Pirates did in Puerto Rico.
Absolutely, Adam. Well said, definitely. And thanks, as always, for the time. Great stuff, as always. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, sounds good.
Awesome. That was Adam Berry. I'm Darwin Zook. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's Monday, November 27th. We're talking some Brewers baseball as we bring in Brewers reporter for MLB.com, Adam McAlvey. Adam, thanks very much for taking the time, as always. And before baseball, I know you're up there in Wisconsin, so the Badgers are kind of on the front of everyone's minds. Have you been following their undefeated run here this season?
Yeah, I helped them by attending the Michigan game.
Oh, excellent.
So that was my contribution to their big season. And, yeah, it was weird to be cheering for Alabama the other day in that game against Auburn, because
right,
we all needed Alabama to win. So we'll see. It'll be interesting. Big game Saturday against Ohio State. That'll sort of decide whether they make it tough on the folks who have to pick the top four.
Absolutely. No, that'll be huge and interesting to see. And then the Brewers sort of going about their offseason right now, no major moves. It's kind of the calm before the storm in general with baseball, with the winter meetings coming up in a couple weeks. But let's start with kind of a big question here for you. A couple names that have been linked somewhat to the Brewers. Jake Arrieta, Lance Lynn, some rumors surrounding those guys. Could Milwaukee be in the market in the hunt for a front of the rotation arm like that?
Well, the short answer is yes, that they could. I mean, they have made no secret that the starting rotation is kind of their primary target this offseason. It's just a matter of how big David Stearns is going to go. And, you know, this is against the backdrop of a team that got ahead of schedule in its rebuild by winning 86 games and coming within a game of the wild card this season that was all ahead of schedule. I think they were probably in their planning looking more at next year in that rich off that free agent class that we're all looking forward to next year as sort of, you know, that would be the time the Brewers would strike. Well, now they find themselves positioned if they choose to go after one of the guys. You know, from a baseball point of view, you can make the case that it's, you know, it's not a bad time to do it. I don't know the answer of whether they will do it. I know that the Brewers, like many other teams, are doing due diligence on a ton of different players right now. Often teams, even if they don't expect to sign one of the big names, they still do other research on that player in case an opportunity comes up, you know, just to strike for a quote-unquote bargain. So, you know, they're doing all that right now. And how big they go is just, I don't know the answer to that. I don't think anyone does at this point. We're just going to have to see as the offseason goes along and the market for those players develops. Are they numbers that make sense for the Brewers?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point, too. Organizations sometimes confronted with a surprising rebuild that comes together quicker than they even thought, and then it's, well, okay, do we change course, or do we keep going in the direction we've been in, and it's a slow build. So that'll be an interesting decision this offseason. One offseason move is in the books. The Brewers did make one move, signing Michael Brady, former A's pitcher. And actually, I was reading your article originally, a shortstop. What can you tell us about Michael Brady?
Yeah. You know, anytime there's a reliever who's a former shortstop, you think of Trevor Hoffman, right? That's the gold standard for converted position players. I don't think Michael Brady is going to be Trevor Hoffman, but he's notable in that he is Milwaukee's first offseason acquisition. Remember, they signed Chase Anderson to an extension. They re-signed Eric Sogard, but Brady becomes their first outside import, a player with a good cutter. Made his major league debut for Oakland last season. His results in the big leagues weren't great, but he has gotten a lot of outs in the minor leagues since converting to pitching. And good swing and miss. Again, like I said, a good cutter. That's a pitch that can, you know, that can play in the big leagues. So an interesting depth signing and a 30-year-old who will come to big league camp. And look, he's the first member of big league camp, really. Obviously, all the 40-man guys will be there, but this is the first official invitation extended. So, you know, congratulations to Michael Brady for getting the Brewers going this winter.
There you go. And okay, I second that. Congratulations to Michael Brady as well. On a somber note, a scary incident, minor league infielder Javier Betancourt suffered a gunshot wound apparently while in Venezuela, but he's okay. What do you know about this whole situation with Betancourt?
Well, exchanged messages with David Stearns after this happened, and basically he said MLB security is going to investigate and get to the bottom of what happened. The headline, as you said, is non-life-threatening injury. He's a right-handed hitter and thrower, so it's his non-throwing arm. But look, I mean, it's obviously a significant incident, and as I was, you know, as this broke last Sunday night of Thanksgiving weekend, the Brewers were still trying to figure out what sort of treatment he's going to require. The reports in Venezuela were that he was coming back to Milwaukee for surgery. David Stearns wasn't willing to go so far initially. They're going to have to figure out whether surgery is required and then sort of what a rehab plan is. He, you know, he's not a top prospect. He's a player they got along with Manny Pena for K-Rod from the Tigers a couple of years ago. It was one of David Stearns, if not David Stearns' very first trade after he took over as Brewers GM. You know, Betancourt's right now looks like organizational depth. He's been at AA the last couple of years. But, I mean, this is it's a reminder. Look, he's a human being, and you get a large group of players in your organization, and it, you know, it reminds you sort of bad things happen. And I sometimes think about this as a GM. You are in charge of an organization with a couple hundred players and a couple hundred front office employees, and that's a heady responsibility. And I think it was, you know, you're reminded sometimes when bad things happen, these are people, and you just at this point, wish the best for this young man, that he's able to get healthy again, get back out on the field, and see where his career takes him.
Yeah, absolutely. And baseball is such an international sport, and just as you mentioned, an organization sort of has an umbrella of players from all over the world, and it's things can happen sometimes. So obviously, hoping the best for Javier Betancourt and his recovery there. And the winter meetings, as we talked about, are a couple weeks away. And we talked about David Stearns. What other players could he possibly be targeting? This rebuild has come about quicker, as you mentioned, and what else could he be targeting other than perhaps front of the line rotation guys going into the winter meetings?
Well, you know, it's a stock answer, I think, for pitching. Every team right now is looking for pitching, and not just, you know, the Yu Darvishes and Jake Arrietas. It's about building depth. You know, you never get through a year with five starting pitchers, for example. You're always going to need 7, 8, 9, sometimes even more guys. And that's the, you know, sometimes these smaller deals can be very important. The other thing is their bullpen is in a little bit of flux. You know, they have Corey Knebel back. We'll have to assign him in arbitration. But Anthony Swarzak was a big-time setup guy for the Brewers down the stretch. He's a free agent who's expressed interest in coming back. A really interesting free agent in that at 31, he had this big breakthrough season. Probably going to be some multi-year offers out there. And as a GM, are you willing to risk a guy on a guy who had a great season but did it at age 31, and it was kind of an outlier for the rest of his career? I think he's one of the really interesting, once we get deep and get some of the top guys signed, players like Anthony Swarzak always are fascinating to see how much they're able to squeeze out of the team, what kind of commitment they're able to get. It's going to be, I think, depth deals like that for the Brewers primarily. They are their core looks set. Or at least developing. They have multiple options in center field. They could bring in a second baseman, or they've got, you know, they've got, I mentioned Eric Sogard. They have Jonathan Villar in arbitration who could be back. You know, they've got options at all these different positions. They're in, as a rebuilding team, they're kind of in the process of sorting through who are going to be our studs when we emerge from this as big-time contenders. I think the acquisitions they're most likely to make this winter are kind of around the edges of that core. Now, all of that is, you know, David Stearns has surprised us before. Who saw Eric Thames coming? He has made some trades that, you know, were a little outside of the box. So I think that's always a possibility this winter as well, that he could, as we talked at the start, make a little bigger splash than perhaps some are expecting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that would certainly get fans even going more, because it was such an exciting year this past year, taking it right down to the final week of the season, competing for a playoff spot. So maybe the offseason can be a way to keep that momentum rolling. And before we let you go, Adam, I just want to ask you about a piece you had written. So much in the offseason is about free agency and money and trades and winter meetings and all that, but we forget about some of the work being done by players and organizations in the community, off the field. And you wrote about Brewers reliever Jacob Barnes, part of a very important project, Stars and Stripes Honor Flight Program. Could you tell us a little bit about what Barnes did and what that program is?
Well, this program is awesome, and it's spreading around the country. But at least in the Milwaukee area here, they have flown 5,500 war veterans. It started with World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, and now as of this fall, they've taken on Vietnam War veterans as well. They fly them from Milwaukee to Washington, D.C., and they tour the different monuments on the National Mall and then bring them back to a hero's welcome in Milwaukee. And it's really incredible to see images of it. It's thousands of people in the airport welcoming these guys home. And in Jacob Barnes' case, he was each of the veterans has a guardian, and often it's a family member, and for some people it's someone they don't know. And Jonathan Lucroy has done this before. Jacob Barnes did it. He served as a guardian to a Vietnam War veteran who was one of three brothers on this flight. They all served in Vietnam at different times. And, you know, the thing that stood out to me as Jacob Barnes was sort of retelling this was those guys came home and they didn't ever get a hero's welcome because of the politics and the situation at the time. And that was, he said, a really special thing to sort of experience, to see these guys get their due for their service. And it was kind of a cool story that we ran out right before Thanksgiving. And Jacob Barnes said it's going to be, you know, he's going to have those three guys on his mind as he sat down with his family on Thanksgiving. Is kind of one of the things that he is thankful for. So a great story. We don't get to tell these stories often enough. Players, as you said, they do things often kind of in the background. They don't do it for attention, but they can really have an impact on a lot of people. And it was very cool to be able to tell just one little story of one player and what he was able to take part in.
Absolutely. No, it was a great piece, Adam. And an interesting point, too, you make in that obviously it was important for those veterans to be able to get that hero's welcome that they didn't fully get due to politics back in the day, but also rewarding for Jacob Barnes to be a part of it and to feel that as well, maybe to write the piece. So everyone feels touched by a story like that. So very cool work there. And before we let you go, Adam, how about a Wisconsin-Ohio State prediction for Saturday? It's a big game there, so what's going to happen?
Well, Ohio State has whipped up on Wisconsin in this game in the past, so I'm going to go modest and say I'll go Badgers 77, Ohio State 3.
It's like the old Saturday Night Lives with Minnie Ditka. The
prediction. You know, why not? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, slightly different accent, but pretty close. I hope they do it. It'd be really cool. It was a lot of fun to be up in Madison a couple of weeks ago and experience the buzz. So go Badgers. See if they can pull it off.
Absolutely. Adam, thanks so much for the time as always. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you again next week. I'm Darwin Zook, and thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's November 28th, and we're talking some Reds baseball. We bring in Reds reporter for MLB.com, Mark Sheldon. Mark, thanks very much, as always, for taking the time. Right now in the offseason, it's kind of the calm before the storm, if you will. The winter meeting's a couple weeks away. But wanted to follow up with you on a piece I was just reading that you wrote at MLB.com about young star outfielder Jesse Winker, played in 47 games, showed he's ready to be in the lineup pretty much every day. But with Scott Schebler and Adam Duvall, is there a bit of a outfield logjam out there, if you will? And how does the team plan on addressing that?
Well, there's really two ways they can go about it. The supposedly the easier way might be to trade either Schebler or Duvall and make space for Winker. There has been no trade rumors linking any club to Schebler or Duvall, but they both are attractive guys in the sense that they can hit for power. Duvall, in his case, he's a very good defensive outfielder. He can do a lot of things both offensively and defensively. Both players, though, struggled mightily in the second half this past year. Duvall didn't have any home runs his last 29 games. So there are some drawbacks. But Winker has shown that he's ready. He can bat leadoff if they don't feel comfortable with Billy Hamilton there. He can bat further down the lineup. He showed some power. I guess I'll throw this as the so-called good problem to have. They don't feel compelled to trade one of those two guys. The other option they have, of course, is to hang on to them and have either the situation work itself out through production, who plays better, or through if there's an injury that could create a situation. And the other option is, short of any of those, is that if they all play maybe 115 to 120 games each in some sort of fashion, everyone gets to play, and then whoever is not playing on a given day becomes Brian Price's best option off the bench, and it would improve their bench a lot. They didn't have a great bench the last couple of seasons. So they can really go in a variety of ways, and if Duvall can play third base, if you have to spell Joey Votto at first base, that's something he can do, and Schebler can spot Billy Hamilton in center field on given days. So that's a way to get all three of them in the lineup.
Yeah, and with a team really trying to rebuild and get back into contention, it's not a big problem to have when you have more talent at a certain spot. It's kind of like, well, you'll take it, I suppose. And along those lines, GM Dick Williams, this offseason now, if he's going to help make a jump for the Reds, say like the Brewers did last year where they're in the rebuilding mode and they suddenly vault into near playoff contention coming up just short of a wild card berth, what would it take for Dick Williams in this offseason to have the Reds propel next year maybe into that Brewers type role and make more of a jump sooner than expected?
It's all going to come down to their pitching. And that last season, there was through the first 59, 60 games, they were just a game or two under 500. They had the makings being similar to the Brewers. It was kind of a surprise, but what was kind of concealed at that time that was obviously a red flag for them was their pitching was really awful, and what they lacked was pitchers that could consistently go deep into games, seven innings, get you know good starts and save the bullpen. The bullpen eventually just ran out of gas, and they weren't able to keep up. So if they can get either some of the guys they've had injured, whether it's Anthony DeSclafani, Homer Bailey, Brandon Finnegan back, if they go out and sign somebody on the outside that can supplement some innings, they have a chance to be really good because their lineup is solid. Even without Zach Cozart, if he doesn't come back as a free agent, they have a very deep lineup. They play good defense. What they didn't have last year was pitching. And if they have that, maybe they can be this year's feel-good story, or the feel-good story for 2018. Excuse me.
Yeah, when you look at, you mentioned the pitching staff, they've already sort of looked to revamp the bullpen here in the offseason, stockpiling several relief arms. Latest, Kyle Crockett, a left-hander coming, claimed off waivers from the Indians. But overall, with the bullpen, when you look at it, and the starting rotation as a whole, what specific names out there, not just their own young talent, but what else is out there that is in their price range that could immediately help them moving forward?
Well, if they look at the bullpen, they're going to be looking at either spot, second-tier names, not the top guys, but there's guys like that are Sergio Romo, for instance, might be available, Andrew Kashner, just different, I mean, I need a starter, but other versions of lower-tiered pitchers. They're not looking for a guy necessarily that can be either only a starter or only a reliever. They're looking at guys that could be swing spot guys. Scott Feldman, who they already had last year, kind of envisioned for that role until all the injuries happened. They kind of want a guy that could be a starter, that can pick up some innings, or be a long reliever and fill in some innings that way. So there's a lot of few different ways they can go. If R.A. Dickey is available, he might be a type of guy. He's 43-something years old, but that's always a possibility. So there's kind of – they're not going to be looking at the Yu Darvish, Jake Arrieta side of the pool. They're going to be looking at the other side and see what they can find.
And just to follow up, too, I mean, fans can get impatient, as we all know. We've all been fans ourselves at one point or another with a team. When you're on the Twitter world and you're listening to fans and people ask you out there, is there frustration with the growth of the team, or is it more excitement about guys like Jesse Winker and their youth moving forward?
It's definitely both, but frustration in the sense that they've waited since 2014 to have a winning team. The rebuild didn't really begin in earnest until 2015, so there's been a lot of guys they've said goodbye to, from whether it's Jay Bruce to Johnny Cueto, Mike Leake, lots of different players that were very, people liked a lot in Cincinnati that were brought back for prospects. Some of these prospects have yet to pan out. Some have done very well in some of these trades. Like Adam Duvall is a product of one of those rebuilding type trades, and he came over in the Mike Leake deal. He's panned out. Others not so good, So it's gonna. They're waiting to see. On the positive side, people are excited about guys like Jesse Winker. They're excited about Nick Senzel, who could be in the major leagues as soon as 2018. He's the team's number one prospect, and he's coming on pretty quick. They're excited about Hunter Green, who's got a long way to go to get to the major league, but he was the second overall pick and obviously came with a lot of fanfare. So there's some things to be excited about with him. Of course, you got the current guys like Eugenio Suarez, Joey Votto, of course, Tucker Barnhart. So there is some positive feelings about the current team. But I think people would like to accelerate this rebuild and get back into contending. It's been a long time now. It's been since 2013 since they were in the wild card, 2012 since they won the division. Fans are kind of irritated, I think, that things haven't moved a little faster.
Yeah, and when they won a couple of those division titles, as we segue over to talking about Scott Rolen, he was a part of a couple division titles with the Reds in the tail end of his career, third baseman, and he's on the Hall of Fame ballot here, and a former Cincinnati Red. What do you think of Rolen's chances of getting into Cooperstown?
I don't think they're very good this year, especially with Chipper Jones and Jim Thome being on the ballot for the first time also, but I think he has a case. If anybody kind of meets the criteria of borderline Hall of Famer, it might be Scott Rolen, because he has a lot of the numbers. He fits in right in with the other Hall of Fame third baseman in terms of his career war. Jay Jaffe, who does a lot of the criteria for whether somebody is a Hall of Famer or not with his own set of numbers, has his numbers of Rolen higher than a lot of the guys that are in the Hall of Fame. Where he falls short, though, of course, is he missed a lot of games with injuries. He does not have an MVP. To his credit, he didn't play particularly well in the postseason other than in the 2006 World Series. He hit like .421. And he doesn't have like the other things like 500 homers or 3,000 hits. So there are some things counting against him. But he was also an 8-time Gold Glover, a 7-time All-Star, and considered the best defensive third baseman of his era. So I think at some point he'll get in. He's just going to be one of those guys that's going to be like others. He starts off small and has to build momentum.
Yeah, definitely. And like you said, even if it's not a first-timer, he'll be on the ballot in the future and get some more opportunities, no question about it. But he's definitely, like you said, one of those borderline cases. As we wrap up here, Mark, so much in the offseason, free agency, money, all these big, you know, big stories, and we forget about sometimes the community events going on, what the players and organizations are doing behind the scenes, both during the season and particularly in the offseason. You wrote about this and the Reds with a big community event, Reds Fest, coming up this weekend. What I read, more than 75 players, coaches, Hall of Famers will be there. Tell us a little bit about what the charity work the Reds have been doing as a team and an organization.
Well, they have a nonprofit arm of the team called the Reds Community Fund. It's headed by Executive Director Charlie Frank, and they're all over the community on a year-round basis, promoting, reaching out to the community, promoting baseball as far as getting opportunities to kids, especially in the urban area and the RBI program, to get involved with baseball. They also have a very heavy input in the MLB Urban Youth Academy, which has become a huge success in only 3 years. And they just were able to have 33 kids from that went through that program and the RBI program go on to college, 15 of them to play baseball or softball. So they feel good about it. And what Reds Fest is one of their biggest fundraisers of the year to benefit the Reds Community Fund. And they do get like 75 current former players. A lot of the greats, like guys like Eric Davis or Barry Larkin have come in past years. And, of course, Joey Votto and the entire current roster is going to attend. Brian Price will be there, general manager Dick Williams. They have a lot of shows and autograph opportunities, photo opportunities. It's very much on par with what you see at the MLB All-Star Fan Fest. The Reds patterned what they saw at previous Fan Fests and made it kind of integrated into the Reds one. They have three different floors of the Duke Energy Convention Center all utilized for this play, for this, you know, event. I saw the MLB All-Star Fan Fest when the All-Star game was here in 2015, and they were very similar, Reds Fest and the All-Star stuff. It's a remarkable event. They do a really good job with it, and if you're in the Cincinnati area, you should check it out.
Absolutely. It sounds like a really awesome event, and Barry Lark and Eric Davis, two of my favorites when I was growing up, so sounds like very cool. Mark, thanks as always for the time, my friend. Great stuff. We'll talk to you again very soon.
All right, thank you.
Absolutely. That was Mark Sheldon. I'm Darwin Zook. Thanks for tuning in on MLB.com Extras. It's Tuesday, November 28th, and we're talking some Cubs baseball. We bring in MLB.com columnist Richard Justice. Richard, thanks as always for taking some time with us here today. And the Cubs with some changes. We'll start right there on their coaching staff for next season, including a new pitching coach, Jim Hickey, reunited with Joe Maddon. They were together with the Rays for 8 seasons. So Hickey replacing Chris Bosio. What can you tell us about Hickey and what type of changes maybe that the Cubs will be undergoing with their pitching staff?
Well, you know, I think part of it is having a new voice. Chris Bosio did a great job as the Cubs pitching coach. He's a very smart guy. He's a tough guy. He had a great communication skills with pitchers. So I think this was a chance for Joe Maddon to just get a different voice, and sometimes you need that. I think any general manager will tell you that there is a life expectancy to each guy. Now, here's what I can tell you about Jim Hickey. First of all, I'm not sure this is important, but he's one of the funniest human beings you will ever meet in your life.
That's very important. I like that.
Yeah. He is a very smart guy. He is very creative. He has a way of communicating with players. He's also, having worked in the Rays organization, he has a comfort level with the data, the analytics, and the ability with analytics. It's not so much absorbing it. It's taking what you feel is necessary, what the pitcher is comfortable with, and translating all those things. So I think in that way he's a guy that Joe is just completely comfortable with. You know, this is going to be a different look for the Cubs coaching staff with Will Venable taking over at first base and Brandon Hyde moving from first base to bench coach and things like that. But it begins with, you know, the hitting coach and the pitching coach have an enormous amount of influence over him. I'll tell you a quick story. When the Astros fired Jim, he was driving back to his home in Kissimmee, Florida. He didn't even get out of the state of Texas before job offers came pouring in. And when the Rays dismissed him after this season, he had his choice of about 5, 6, 7 jobs. A bunch of teams wanted him. That's the reputation he has. So, you know, we're going to when we look at the offseason, we're going to look at pitchers added and, you know, all of that stuff. But this is an impact addition, and the Cubs want a very spirited competition to get Jim Hickey on the staff.
Absolutely, and if sense of humor is important, we know it is with Joe Maddon, then those two will be reunited and get right to work and fit together very well once again, no question there. Obviously, winter meetings a couple weeks away, and it's a little, the calm before the storm right now. No major moves yet in the off season, but Shohei Ohtani, Giancarlo Stanton, the two moves that seem to be everyone's waiting to happen for those two dominoes to fall, and then we get more into free agency and trades and everything else. But let's focus on the two-way prodigy Ohtani for a moment. He's been linked to many teams, and the Cubs are one of those teams. What's the realistic expectation you think of the Cubs perhaps landing this future star?
Well, he fits in that the Cubs need pitching. And I mean, the idea, Theo Epstein's idea now is to add at least one back-end bullpen guy and two starting pitchers. They've been linked with Alex Cobb. In terms of the bullpen, they haven't ruled out Wade Davis, but you know, there are a lot of bullpen options out there. I don't think they've ruled out Jake Arrieta, but Jake wants to go and see what his price is. They weighed in on Zach Britton. The price was too high there with Baltimore. Brandon Morrow's a name that comes up. So how would Ohtani fit in? I think at the end of the day, my bet is that he's going to go to a team, an American League team, because the option of DHing. I think everybody's still trying to get their minds around, okay, he's going to start on Tuesday, and he's going to have 4 days. And normally the pitchers work pretty hard in those 4 days between. There's some rest, but there's throwing, there's legwork, all of that. And I think everybody's trying to figure out, okay, how is the guy going to get his work in and then pitch? But everybody's committed to doing it. And here's the advantage the Cubs have. They have one of the most creative, innovative, open-minded managers that's ever managed in Joe Maddon. You ask any player that has played for Joe, they like playing. The other part of that is, in Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer, the Cubs have two guys at the chart at the top of the baseball ops who will be creative and will figure out ways that Ohtani can get his at-bats. You know, it's not the perfect fit because they have Anthony Rizzo at first base, and I don't think anybody thinks that he's going to play the outfield that many times. But we're in unexplored territory in all of this. So I think he has an open mind, and what he's asked teams to do, as you know, is to just give me a proposal on how it worked out. You know, if you're just looking from baseball and endorsements, the Yankees are a perfect baseball fit. They need a DH. They need a starting pitcher. It's a good fit, and also the endorsement opportunities are pretty enormous in New York City. Having said that, the endorsement opportunities are pretty substantial in Chicago too. So I think it's going to come down. It's not going to come down to money. It's going to come down to where Ohtani is most comfortable, and the competition between the Rangers, the Yankees, other teams is going to be very, very fierce. So we'll see. We know this. We know the Cubs are going to add starting pitching, and he is one of the better arms out there.
Yeah, Richard, you mentioned that word comfort. That seems to be an important factor when such high expectations. I remember when Daisuke Matsuzaka came to the Red Sox and the high expectations there, and he had a decent career but didn't totally fulfill the high expectations everyone had for him at that time. With someone like Ohtani, from what you know, what you've read from talking to people, does he seem composed, poised, ready for those type of expectations wherever he goes, especially in a big market?
Yeah, it's funny when you watch him. Or you watch him on video, you watch him walk, you go, yep, that's a star. I mean, he carries himself like a star. And I think part of that, I mean, is the coverage of him has been so intense in Japan that I don't think anything the New York media, the Chicago media, any place is going to throw at him that he's going to be put off by. I don't think it's going to impact him. He is a big deal. And look, he's a game changer because you look at Brendan McKay was the fourth overall pick of the draft last year. The Rays have him both pitching and playing first base and DHing in the minor leagues, and he seemed to do it just fine. It worked. And we always have scouts every year look at prospects and say, they argue, okay, is this guy a pitcher or a hitter? And whenever the guy doesn't make it as a pitcher, you hear a dozen scouts say, well, I tried to tell my guy he should have been an outfielder, all of that. But now we're going to open the door permanently. Once it's open, I think it's going to be open for a long time, especially if it works, that we're going to look at players that have the ability to do that. Brett Eibner was drafted out of Arkansas by the Royals as an outfielder, but he pitched at University of Arkansas. The Dodgers sent him back to the minor leagues this year and said, okay, you're going to learn to pitch too. We're going to save a roster spot. He blew out his elbow, but the plan long term is to do both things. So Ohtani is a game changer, and I just think he is going to be a huge, intriguing star. I've already been thinking about that. Like, wherever he is, when he makes his first appearance, there's going to be a ton of media there. It was not probably even more intense coverage than Darvish, but he seems to be ready for it.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating story. Exciting to see what happens. We're talking with MLB.com columnist Richard Justice. Just going back over to the Cubs a little more, Richard. Obviously, last season, Cubs had a hangover, World Series hangover, maybe part of the year, but then turns it on at the end. They win the NL Central before falling to the eventual NL champion Dodgers in five games. So now in the offseason, how do the Cubs sort of reboot going forward? Jake Arrieta, free agent. He's a Scott Boras client, so we know he's going to command some money there. What's your sense with what Theo Epstein does with Arrieta? Wade Davis, also a free agent, in terms of re-looking at the pitching staff going forward?
Well, the phrase you used, World Series hangover, was perfect, because I have a sense, in just talking to people there, that the club, they played 521 games the last 3 years. They won 311, more than any team in baseball, but they've also played more than any team in baseball, and I think they just hit a wall. I mean, you want to play, you want to keep going, but when you have a short off season and then you have another long season, eventually you do hit a wall. The Cubs feel like, okay, we've got Lester, Hendricks, Quintana, Butler, Montgomery. And the other part of that is, and I think this infects free agency, eight of their top 10 prospects, including some are very close to being ready for the major leagues, are pitchers. Their system is flush with pitching. But when you're in a win-now mode and you've got a 20-something team, I think it's been on opening day, Ben Zobrist, if he's in the opening day lineup, will be the only player that's had a 30th birthday. They're still a young team. What they need is at least one starting pitcher. They've been linked to Alex Cobb. We mentioned Ohtani and what he would give them. They have not closed the door on Arrieta. They, like the rest of us, love Wade Davis. They feel like he'd be great, but Wade's going to go out and engage the market. That leads to, do you shop for Jake McGee? Brandon Morrow would make a lot of fit. Their relievers had trouble throwing strikes last year. Brandon Morrow is a strike thrower. Tommy Hunter resurrected his career in Tampa. And then you just go down the list of starting pitchers. Some of the projections have them making a big investment in Yu Darvish. That makes some sense because they have about $40 million to spend. So the focus is exclusively on pitching. There has been speculation, would you trade some of those position players, i.e. Kyle Schwarber? It's a challenge for Joe to work him into the lineup. Would you trade him to get a pitcher? I would bet, knowing Theo and Jed and how they think, I would think they would try to go the free agency route, that when you have a core of young guys the way they do, you want to try to keep them together. But let's just say they're in a great spot. I know their farm system didn't have any of our top 100 prospects at MLB.com, but they are flush with pitching. And their position players are already in the major leagues. They're in a great spot, and I think if you're projecting the NL Central going into 2018, you know, the Cardinals intend to be very aggressive, but you still begin with the Cubs.
And Richard, just to wrap up, one final question for you. A couple former Cubs first-time nominees on the Hall of Fame ballot, pitchers Kerry Wood, Carlos Zambrano. Wood's career, as we know, really hampered by injuries at times. You need 5% of the vote to stay on the ballot. Do those guys stay on? And what's your memory of those two pitchers?
Well, my memory of Kerry Wood is 20 strikeouts against the Astros, and it was one of those days when the Astros were not frustrated at all. They just said, he was better than us. He struck out 266 in the 2003 season, and we thought in Wood and Pryor, the Cubs are going to have a combination that is good enough to anchor the franchise for years. As you mentioned, injuries didn't allow him to do that, and injuries will probably keep him out of the Hall of Fame, but he's some really special memories. My memory of of Carlos Zambrano is a no-hitter against the Astros when they had to play a makeup game after a hurricane, another hurricane in 2007 in Milwaukee, and he was absolutely unhittable at his best. Lance Berkman once told me, he said, when he's going to pitch against us tonight, notice the radar gun in the first inning. If it says 95, we're cooked, because that's not a 95-mile-an-hour fastball. That's a 95-mile-an-hour sinker.
Wow.
So at his best, he won 132 games, handed ERA under 4. He was as good as anybody ever.
Richard, thanks so much for the time. As always, great stuff. Look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Richard Justice, MLB.com columnist. I'm Darwin Zook, and thanks for tuning in to MLB.com Extras.